This is The Producers, a podcast. The biggest names in audio production, station sound, radio imaging, branding, and voiceover. Interviews, tips, tricks, advice. To be a part of the show, visit RyanOnTheRadio.com. Now, The Producers with Ryan Dreen.
Hey, thanks again for checking it out. I believe we're on episode 43. I never bothered to check before I start yapping, but I am yapping nevertheless. I won't waste too much time here in the intro. Brian Lee is the guest, obviously. Had a lot of requests for Brian over time, and finally we got it worked out. I mean, the dude is busy. One of the most, I would say, heard voices, definitely in America. I know he's doing some worldwide stuff, but I mean, as far as the states go, he's on all the major platforms, and he's on a lot of the major platforms, but still does a ton of radio imaging work, local TV promo work, and then obviously all the humongous network stuff, movie trailers. One of my favorite things, as I mentioned in the podcast, is his work he does with NBC Sports, and specifically his Super Bowl stuff this past year. But anyway, the interview is going to be great. I did break it down into three pretty manageable parts. We yapped for a while. I thought maybe I'd get like 20 or 30 minutes of his time, and I would be thankful for that. I ended up getting delayed by a couple few weeks, but finally Friday, we talked, and I think we actually were on the phone together for about 2 hours, including one cutout. We neither of us were on a cell phone, but somehow the phone still dropped. I think someone was trying to tell us, hey guys, perhaps it's time for you to end your interview. But no, it was really cool. I did edit it down, though, so you're not going to have to endure 2 hours of us yapping. But Brian was very open about everything. In fact, one of my favorite things is when guys actually get down to the nuts and bolts of the money side of things. Now, while I didn't ask him what he makes on everything he does, he did get into some of the cash deals and a very specific deal he signed. And I think it's interesting to hear that kind of stuff. But he was very candid about who he thinks he is, what he thinks about the industry, and what he thinks people can do in this industry. We also get very technical. You're going to find out every single little nook and cranny of his mic chain and the technical aspects of how he works and what he has. So if you're interested in that, I got it all out of him. We talk about his road gear also, by the way. So anyway, part one, we're going to get mostly into his background, where he's been, a little more philosophical stuff, stay more general like I've always done, and we'll get a little more specific as part two and three roll on. In fact, I will fire off some great Brian Lee audio. No doubt you've heard his voice. You're very familiar with him. I'll tell you about what's coming up on the podcast at the end of part three. So if you're interested in that, well, you're just going to have to, I don't know, fast forward or do whatever you do. Otherwise, here is Brian Lee's interview, and thanks so much again for checking this out.
One of the most beloved stories of all time.
Who are you?
Snow White.
Is coming to life in the motion picture event of the year.
Do you want to hear it?
Yeah! This spring, in an enchanted kingdom where anything is possible.
I will not fight a bunch of dwarves. You're minuscule.
Something funny is going on. Mirror, Mirror, rated PG, in theaters March 30th. Congratulations to the Super Bowl champion New York Giants. And thank you, America, for making Super Bowl 46 on NBC the most watched show in U.S. television history.
Here you are, you're 19, and you're in the swimming pool with the President of the United States.
The team from Rock Center with Brian Williams, now on Wednesdays, 9, 8 Central on NBC.
And there you know the voice. Absolutely, I would say 99% of the people tuning into this definitely know who Brian Lee is. Brian, we got this worked out. I got some of your time, and thanks for joining me on this show.
Oh, my pleasure. Absolutely.
I send out a little notice to the listeners. I have a pretty large email list now, and getting you was made people very excited. You have a lot of fans out there. A lot of questions were submitted for you, so. On behalf of them, definitely thanks.
Awesome.
We're going to go through a few things. I do want to start with your background, but we'll kind of, what percentage of your work is voiceover right now?
All of it.
Yeah, I was going to assume 100.
Yeah, 100%. That's all I do. I used to do, you know, production, and I like to dabble in it again, but now there's just really not any time to do it. It's all 100% voiceover from... from beginning to end.
For people that didn't know, and you just mentioned it, now you used to be in the world of production, radio imaging producer. That's true.
Yeah, you know, I started in radio. My father was a television news anchor man, and my mom and dad met at Channel 7 in Miami in 1966. And my dad was in Norfolk, Virginia at Channel 3. And my mom, before they had met, was like the assistant to the news director at Channel 7. And my father applied for a job and got the job in Miami. And that's where mom and dad met. And that's where I was born. And so I followed, you know, my dad around, you know, through all my years with him working in radio news and television reporter and anchorman and, you know, news director. So I was really exposed to it really early on. And my dad's my hero. I mean, he, you know, we're just alike, and we're just massive, massive nerds, you know.
Aren't we all?
It was news and television and radio and satellite dishes and music. It just, and radio jingles. My God, I'm such a jingle nerd.
You're one of those people, huh?
Oh God, you know, I got them. I collected them. I mean, I haven't listened to them in a long time. Anyway, that's how it all started. You know, it just, my father in radio and TV. So I always knew that I always wanted to be in broadcasting somehow, some way.
Let me ask you, a couple questions about that. Did your dad, you mentioned Miami and then you also said Atlanta, but did he have a career where he had to kind of bounce around different jobs, or was he lucky enough
You know it. You know, was born in Miami, and he worked at Channel 7 and Channel 10, and then we went to Sarasota because he got hired by Storer Cable. Interestingly enough, the radio station that he worked at or discovered when he was 16, because he grew up in Sarasota, I ended up working at like in 1986 and 1987 in the same building on the same little island. So, you know, it was kind of cool. But then we moved to Panama City, where he worked for Channel 13. Then we moved to Albany, Georgia, where he was at Channel 10. And then we moved to Fort Myers 27 years ago, where he was the news director of the ABC affiliate here. And I stayed ever since. I came here when I was 15, and now I'm 42. I've been here ever since.
Yeah, I knew you were pretty much a Florida guy. So how early did you get your first official job in either radio or broadcasting? Or did you go off and do something else? Were you in college, you know, or did you wait a while?
No, not at all. I was, I was playing around at the TV station at Channel 10 in Albany, Georgia, where my dad was, playing around in the audio booth and in the video editing bays and stuff. And so by the time I turned about 13 years old, there was a station, back then it was all AM FM combos, and it was WALG and WKAK, and it was an AM FM, and 1590 WALG was this 5,000 watt top 40 station. And the FM side was a country station. So one night, you know, I'm 13, I'm just like every other groupie, you know, talking to the DJ on my clock radio, you know, the night jock. And he says, I said, I really would love to come out. And he was explaining the board to me. I said, well, what's it like? What's the control room like and everything? He goes, well, we have this big board. It's got big knobs on it and big meters. It was, the board was made by Autogram. I don't, you know, I'm a tech head. So it was just a big 10 pot board.
Yeah.
And, he explained to me, he was saying, yeah, there's program and there's audition and there's cue. And we have these big reel-to-reel machines that play the music. And I said, well, I'd love to come out and see it. He goes, well, you know, after everyone goes home, I start at 7. So if you want to come out one night. So sure enough, one night I came out and the jock was 18 years old. His name was Rick Stewart. And, he let me, you know, push buttons and turn knobs and everything. And after I got good at it, he would go and have sex with his girlfriend out in this car, out in the parking lot while I ran the radio station. So that was fun. And then I discovered the production room. You know, waiting for songs to end and just sitting there waiting for the light to come on, the cue light, so I could push the next button. That was fun, but it got kind of boring. So I made my way into this antiquated production room with a big Gates tube production board and one giant meter on it, because it was mono, right?
Yeah.
And it was a giant windshield wiper meter on it. And then I discovered radio and production and carts and records and just junk, and I couldn't get out of it. And then ever since then, so about 13, I played around in the radio station and finally got hired by another station in town when I was 15 years old. WJAZ 960. It was a country station. And that's where I got my first start.
Yep. So you're one of those guys. You started real early. And
oh, yeah.
You were locked in. You had the Kool-Aid early and you haven't left?
No. Uh-uh. It's just, that's the way it was, you know? I mean, so, I can ask you this question. I mean, have you had the radio dream?
Well, yeah. I mean, anyone who's a jock has had multiple of those, right?
Right. Yeah, but, and only jocks would really understand what the radio dream is.
Yeah. Like the dead air dream. I mean, that's,
yes, absolutely.
You know, that's
the dead air dream, looking over, there's nothing in the cart rack, or there's no CDs to play, or it's all the wrong music, or a song faded out, or you wake up and you found out you've been asleep for 4 hours and you're just waiting for the program director to call and fire you.
I always think about, you know, guys that are in charge of, you know, launching nuclear missiles. They wake up the dream of, oh, I just blew up the world. We wake up the dead air dream, and it's the same cold sweat. You know what I mean? It's sad,
right?
But the body is acting the same as if the world just exploded, or we just let dead air happen. You know,
right? Yeah, we get fired, and they kill 20 million people.
Right,
yeah.
Right. They end humanity, and at the end of the day, we don't. You know, but enough of that. So you dive into imaging production. You know, tell me a little bit about you. Start. You said you started on tape. How long did you do that for? And, and then obviously you started utilizing your voice. Were you utilizing your voice from the beginning?
No, because like my voice was about like this when I got started. So
yeah,
it only changed about a year ago.
Okay, well, that's good. It was about time, I guess.
It's an amazing story. When I was a kid in 1985, a radio station in Columbus, Georgia. So I lived in Albany, Georgia, which was southwest Georgia. 100 miles to the north, we had the station called V103. It was a country station. And January 1st, 1985, they blew it up and it became a top 40. Now, I've been living in Georgia, this little town in Georgia, for 6 years. I didn't know what imaging was, what amazing radio was. And this station came on the air and it was absolutely fabulous. And a guy by the name of Russ Brown was the general manager, but the program director, but he put it on the air. He also put on K92 in Roanoke, which I voiced today. He put K92 on in Roanoke, and he came down, and I didn't realize that he had put Kiss FM on. I moved to Fort Myers in 1985. This is 2.5 years later. I apply for a job at this radio station, and I go down and I meet this guy, and I look on his desk, or he had a briefcase on the side of his desk, and it said Kiss FM on. There was a laminated card thing on it. And I looked at it. I said, "You worked for Kiss FM in Columbus? Oh my God, you know, I'm peeing in my pants."
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "I actually put it on the air." And I was like, "Oh my God." And then I start reciting his imaging back to him. The switch is on, you know, to the all new, all hit Kiss FM. And his jingles, you know, Kiss FM. And he was like, "Oh my God, somebody knows my work." So he had a parting with the company. He was down there. So I met him and he taught me everything. Russ Brown was the most amazing teacher. He taught me about compression. He taught me about equalization. He taught me about tape and phase and carts and transmitters and STL. He taught me about multiband processing and the Optimod. He was an engineer and a program director and a good one at that. And I just got fascinated by processing and reverb and phase and sampling but you know, this was in the 80s, so we had like reel-to-reel machines, so
yeah, it wasn't so easy back then.
No, but you know something, there was such a passion for it that I was in the production room and I was like the night jock, so I started at 7, I got off the air at midnight and went into the production room and stayed in there until the sun came up. I really loved imaging, and imaging was just coming around in the very early 90s, and I was imaging for the radio station. It wasn't my voice. It was a guy named Ray Otis. And I got this idea to run an ad in Radio and Records newspaper. Mm-hmm. And they just had they had sections like IDs, jingles, sweepers. Or IDs and jingles. I don't think the sweepers had not been invented yet.
Yeah.
Really. We didn't know liners, you know, whatever. And I got an idea to put an ad in there. Not for voiceover, but for production. And there was nobody doing freelance production back then. big stations had their guys in their production rooms, like the Rick Allens and the Dave Foxes and the, you know, they had, the big operations had, you know, guys in the studios, but little radio stations had production directors and they were not the least bit interested in doing imaging.
Yep.
So I ran an ad and I called it The Advantage, Get the Advantage. And, you know, there was no internet back then. So I set up an answering machine in my house, put a phone line in, and the number was like 768 demo. And I put a cassette tape in there of this guy Ray Otis doing liners, and then ran an ad and said, call this number. And people started leaving messages saying, we love that. We love the production. How much is it? And then I started producing Ray Otis's voice, not mine, Ray Otis's voice. And then Chris Corley was also in Fort Myers when I was a teenager. He came down to work as a jock on 96 K-Rock. And if anybody knows Chris Corley, which everybody knows Chris Corley. He's just a freaking fabulous star and just an amazing, amazing talent. And he was getting freelance voiceover work. But the agencies had not yet found, the agents had not found out that it was a lucrative business yet. It was this hidden thing, you know. And I was talking to him and he said, Brian, how does it, I said, I want to market you. This is before I even started being a voiceover guy. Freelance, a real freelance one. And I said, what, he said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm producing. And he said, well, what do you get? I said, I don't know, like $200 to do with 20 sweepers or whatever. And I split the $200 with the voiceover guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, okay. And then like in August of 92, Chris says to me, he goes, why don't you put people on retainer fee? And I said, oh, no one's going to pay a retainer fee. And he goes, oh yes, they will. And I was like, really? They'll pay monthly for this stuff? Are you kidding me? So I was making $100 a month producing, you know, Corley would voice it. It took him 3 minutes to voice 20 liners and it took me 5 hours to put it together.
I made my,
it's no Pro Tools back then. It was all reel-to-reel, but I made my $100 and I'm like, I have a client. And then I started, you know, because of what Chris said. He says, put people on retainer. And before I knew it, I was producing Chris's voice on KLOS in Los Angeles and WNEW in New York, and it started picking up.
Just to advance a little bit, so about how many years were you, you know, kind of focusing on the imaging, and then at what point did you start, let's just say, do more work with your voice than you did in production?
Let's see, 93 I left and started Advantage Productions, which was the very first, that's what that whole thing turned into, was the first multi-voiced image marketing production company ever. And I became one of the voices, you know, a lot of people, I think, really came out of Advantage Productions. Chris got a lot of his work until he got an agent. And then he really got a lot of work. Jeff Berlin, I think Jeff Berlin was, I think his first marketing was through Advantage Productions. We started a catalog of voices, you know, voice one, voice two, voice three. And I became one of them. And then I started picking up radio stations. I was voicing top 40 stations. And interesting, when I got an agent, when I decided I really wanted to do voiceover freelance and thought I could do the big stuff, was about 1990, I'm going to say about 98. And of course, being a production guy, I can make my own demo.
Right.
So, you know, I went in my home studio, I made a demo that sounded like I was the voice of freaking McDonald's and ABC. And the agents weren't any, you know, they didn't know. And then a great female talent named Laura Kane, she was a friend and I used her. She was one of the voices on our demos back at Advantage for imaging. So she got an agent and she was doing national work. And she said, you know, you should really let me introduce you to my agent in California. And it was Kama Nist. And Kama was, who's now the N of DPN. She heard my demo and said, we want to sign you. She was out in LA and I got signed by New York and I didn't really do that much work. I didn't really understand the big agent whole thingy.
Yeah.
But I did pick up a TV station in Miami, the WB affiliate. And then I left CED and Haas called me from Atlas Talent Agency. And
good old Haas.
Good old Haas. And Haas. And but you know, it wasn't – Haas became familiar with me because of Chris Corley. It was one of those days where, you know, it just got Haas on a good day, and he said, are you happy at CED? I said, no. He goes, you want to come over here? I'm like, yeah. So, you know, I came over and started with Atlas Talent Agency and immediately booked CNN, the Connie Chung Tonight Show. Hmm. So that was it. That was the first big thing. And I remember the agent calling me and saying, hey, you booked this. And I'm like, cool. I'm like on CNN now. Holy shit. You know? And I can't believe it. I'm, you know, I've been doing one TV station and voicing radio stations, and now CNN wants you. And this is in like early 2000s, like 2002. I was like 10 years ago. I was completely blown away. And I remember I said, well, what does it pay? You know, because I'm used to making, you know, $600, $700 a month doing a radio station a month. And she says, and it was like, it just flowed out of her mouth like it was nothing. It pays $120. I'm like, okay, $120 a session? And she goes, no, $120,000. And I was like, what? I was like, $120,000? You know, it was like, yeah, you get $60,000 for the promos and another $60,000 to do the in-show or something. It was like, my God.
And so tell me about how much work was that? You know, that was obvious. That was an annual retainer. Is that what that is?
It was 2 6-month contracts for this show. And it was a daily thing. It was like tonight, you know, whatever the promo was, it was like tonight, you know, Miners Trapped, you know, or whatever. And so I had one session a day. That's
and
it.
What was that? Maybe 30 minutes?
No, it was more like 5.
Okay, so not 2 hours.
I no.
Mean 5 minutes.
It was like 5 minutes a day, and I wait for the producer to call me and say, okay, we're faxing you the scripts.
Yeah.
And, you know, and okay. Then we jumped on an ISDN line, and we did it. And you know, that's how that whole thing worked. And then the war started. I think the Gulf War something started in the show. Connie Chung's show, you know, freaking blew. And so they pulled it off the air and they stopped the show. But they had me under contract. So I sat around just making money for doing nothing. CNN was paying me.
They didn't utilize you anywhere else?
Well, no. Well, they actually.
Or you're couldn't they?
Very, very, very good, Ryan. They did. They didn't want to sit on paying me $120,000 a year and not use me. Because the show only aired for, I think, 3-4 months before they pulled it. And I'm making all this money for just doing nothing. So they said, well, let's start using him. And so what they did is they stopped paying me that amount of money, and then started eating away. They would hire me to do Larry King promos and Paula Zahn promos and things, and that ate away at it until they just used up all their money. And then they disappeared for a little while. But then it's by that time, because of Atlas Talent Agency and all the getting exposed, you know, I started picking up, you know, like CNBC, which I'm still on now, 10 years now. All this extra work. So CNN was my very first big, oh my God thing. And then, it just started turning into, you know, all sorts of little cable channel things here and there and whatnot. And that it just kind of expanded out from there.
And, when you picked up CNN, you still were doing the imaging production. You were actually producing stuff at that point.
And not
right?
only was I doing that, I was running my production company. So I had like car dealership ad agencies standing in the doorway waiting for me to finish my CNN session so they could come in so I could sit down and edit together car commercials.
So at what point in your head, I mean, you had to it from time to time go, all right, I'm making, I don't know, literally the equivalent of $50,000 an hour because, you know, you're making a grand every 10 minutes, whatever it was.
Right.
And then you've got these sort of local agencies like, hey, here's your $123 for my car spot.
Right.
You know, so at what point in your head did you kind of go, all right, I don't want to get a big head, but you guys are going to have to sort of go away now?
Oh, I hired somebody to come in and help me in the production company. I had two studios, my studio, and I had the big project room, big Pro Tools project room down the hall. So various people came in to work for me. And then a college buddy came in and ran my production company for the last 8 years until just at the end of 2010, actually. And I gifted the entire production company to him. equipment.
And so is it still called Advantage, or do you want to talk about that?
No, my father and I split actually in 97. We started together in 92. We ended in 97. And then I started Sky Audio Productions.
And that's Sky Audio because
I wanted to, my father and I, he wanted to stay in radio imaging and I wanted to get into, you know, audio for video, music, post-production, yeah. things like that. And we did that. And he ended up selling to a company in Auburn who made it Studio 197. And he did that, I think, in the year 2000. So, and that company's still in business. That's one of those multi-voiced image marketing companies, you know.
I don't know if you're one of the I think he's in New York City still. Nick Carter sent in a pretty long question, but it's a good question, and it kind of goes along with what you've been talking about. I'm going to read it all to you. It's a little long, but anyway, Brian, I credit you and a few others like Steve Stone for really breaking through and changing the sound of network promo from the big deep voice thing to much of what it is today. He asks, how did you develop your distinctive sound? How much trial and error did it take experimenting with other sorts of reads before you found your sweet spot? And were you at times either on your own or at the behest of your agents tempted to try and sort of be that big voice, you know, compete in that side of things? Do you agree with what he said, or can you answer his questions in general?
It's kind of that way. You know, I would probably say that I'm probably one of the luckiest people on the planet because everything worked out perfectly. You know, I mean, when I got started, when I got an agent, Atlas Talent Agency was a young agency. It had only been in business for about 2 years, even though everybody kind of came over from Buchwald, started the company. But the company wasn't very big, and it had a handful of very big, heavy hitters like Chris Corley.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I came on, and back in the early 2000s, I think that really the only thing that you, Don LaFontaine was, you know, the big voice. So you had big voices, and then Joe Cipriano.
Yeah.
Joe Cipriano should really actually get all the credit for networks turning to a younger sound rather than a massive deep guy.
Or maybe Fox gets some of that credit.
Fox does. Fox gets the credit, but without Joe Cipriano making it okay, you know.
Yeah.
And Joe got it. You know, he was a radio guy, and he got it because, you know, Fox started, and there was a big deep voice guy who decided to go on vacation or something like that right after the network started. And they said, you can't leave. And we just started a network. And the guy goes, well, I'm going on vacation. So they hired Joe. And then to this day, yeah. you know, Joe's made millions and millions and millions of dollars.
Yeah, Sip's the best.
You know, and become extremely successful because of that. And so really, I think that Joe made that whole networky thing okay. Especially for the comedy part. And then so you had the really deep and you had the really energetic high, and there was nothing going on in the middle.
Yep.
Nothing. There was nobody doing this kind of read. Now everybody does that. You know, there's 1,000 Brian Lee disciples out there. But in the early 2000s, there was just nobody doing it. And it was one of those things, you know, Ryan, right place, right time.
So at the time when CNN brought you on like that, though, I mean, they were gambling a little bit, right? Because on that platform, no one was presenting in that manner using a Brian Lee. Is that true?
Yeah, probably. I mean, no, I don't think so. But CNN, but, you know, I'd like to think that I have a certain amount of range, you know, that I can do this.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I can all do, you know, also do this. So I'm to this day, I'm still doing, you know, trailers that are like, you know, that are down in this range, you know. You know, I just started a movie campaign today for the new Disney film, and it's all like this, you know. It's the, you know, a family, you know, with a surprise, you know. But at the same time, yesterday I was doing Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, you know, which is like Donatello, you know. And so the range was there. So I could still, it wasn't like CNN was taking too much of a, I don't have this brassy, deep, huge Corley voice, but I know how to use it. And so all of a sudden it was one of these things like, oh my God, you know, we can use Brian Lee to do anything. We can use him to do a serious, you know, death and destruction and somebody died, all the way up to, you know, an Emmy Award show. So it was one of these things where I started getting a lot of bookings. for everything. Because and then the money read, you know, in the agency business, they call it the money read. So it's in the middle, you know, kind of like the kind of voice like this. And you hear people doing it like on USA and on Sci-Fi and on A&E and on Lifetime and on everyone has that middle. Anybody can do the middle thing, you know, but that was the money read. So I started picking up, you know, NBC Network. I mean, I became the voice of NBC in like 2006, 7, 8, all from Fort Myers, Florida on an ISD inline. And my managers at Wintner Artist Management would give me all my trailer work and everything. They went into NBC and Ashton was on his way out and they said, we want you to hear this guy. And they did. And NBC shut down their entire promotions department for an hour and a half to jump on an ISD inline with me for me to voice every single show on NBC as an audition. Live. I mean, I'm not talking to just a I'm talking about the audio being fed down the ISD and I'm reading against the show, promo, music, sound on tape, everything. I don't know anybody who can get an opportunity like that today. It was just so freaking epic to be able to audition like that. And then they're like, hire him. And then so, and then with that came things like Sci-Fi. I mean, the voice of Sci-Fi for 3-4 years, you know, A&E, CNN and CNBC at the same time, you know, it just started picking up so much and then started in movie trailers. So it was one of these things where it was so right place, right time, and so fortunate. And before really a lot of the talent started kind of catching on to this kind of read, and it's not this, but it, you know, the kind of down the middle read, and then the read that wasn't pukey, the read that was like, hey, you know, this kind of read, you know, only on, you know, only on A&E, that I was so established by that time that it was just, you know, doing very, very, very well and very, very happy. So, I think it was just, like I said, right place, right time. And I've been able to, and now there's, because of ISDN and because of the internet, everybody can do it now. And that's wonderful that anybody can do voice work. If you're halfway decent, you can do it. Mm-hmm. And you can make a very, very good living doing it. So, you know, kudos to any guy out there who wants to put up a website, you know. And any guy who wants to put up a website or put his demo on Voice123 and put together a demo, and you know, if you're halfway decent, because you're going to get better. I mean, I'm better now than I was 10 years ago. You're going to get work and you're going to make money.